You're listening to District Sentinel Radio. This is your nightly newscast featuring some reporting from the left. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're broadcasting out of the Harper is a Good Girl studios. I can still smell her scent around here. Check out our website, districtsentinel.com.
As some of you are probably aware, there was a special election last night in Kansas, and the Democratic candidate almost pulled off an unthinkable upset, no thanks to the dim party establishment. We'll have a special interview for you later. Ben Poteet, a military advisor for the James Thompson campaign, will chat about the race.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to go too easily on the Democratic Party after this one.
No. I mean, you know.
But we never do. So just another Wednesday in the Sentinel Fort with the Democratic Party disappointing us. Also, an update on some breaking news from this morning. We have word that Housing Secretary Ben Carson was rescued from a stuck elevator. He was at a public housing complex in Miami when it happened. For some reason, Alonzo Mourning was there too, though Mourning didn't get stuck in the elevator. It took 20 minutes, but Carson was eventually freed. Listeners, tweet at us who you think the next conservative will be that gets stuck in an elevator. I think it was Brendan James who wrote the article about the phenomenon of Republicans, especially never Trumpers at the time. Now we've got even it happening to Trumpers.
Well,
stuck in elevators.
Ben Carson once challenged Trump. Remember, he was a presidential candidate. So, you know, that sticks with you, and the elevator gods remember these types of things.
Yeah, if you guess the right guy to get stuck in an elevator next, we'll send you a t-shirt or something. By the way, speaking of those t-shirts, I haven't been doing a great job at sending them out to our March Madness winners, our tournament winners, but I'll send out the t-shirts to the top three people who won. And that means whoever is SoapChack security, let us know. That they got second place in the so if your bracket was SoapChack security, I don't know who you are. So
show yourself, second place coward.
Message us on Patreon or tweet at us something so we can send you your t-shirt that you've earned. All right, let's get on with the show. It's Wednesday, April 12th, 2017. Here's the news. First, on foreign policy matters, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov gave a joint press conference on Wednesday, following a day of meetings, including one meeting that included a sit-down with Vladimir Putin. And for about 40 minutes, the two men addressed the media. It became really clear that U.S. and Russian relations had really degraded, and that maybe Russia didn't get the working partner in the Trump government that it had hoped for.
That is, until the compromat comes out.
Yes, any minute now, the piss tape has to drop based on how this press conference went. Tillerson accused the Assad regime of last week's chemical attacks, but Lavrov denied the allegation and called for an investigation. Tillerson said it was known that the Russians tried to interfere in the U.S. election last year. Lavrov denied that. When Tillerson talked about how Syria's future cannot include Assad, Lavrov went into full lecture mode and ran down the list of failed U.S. interventions in recent years from Iraq to Libya.
We have had sort of a historical background. Rex said that he's a new guy and he prefers not looking into history but to deal with the matters of today. But the thing is, the world is built in such a fashion that if we do not take lessons from the past, we will hardly be able to achieve success in the present.
The press conference was a lot of lecturing from Lavrov to Tillerson, I noticed.
Yeah. I noticed the word Novi Chelovik, new guy.
He's the new guy.
And he was like, I'm not saying it's bad, he's the new guy, but here's a bunch of historical things that you need to know. I don't know. It didn't sound like Rex had the best day.
No, it didn't seem like the most productive meeting in Moscow for Trump's State Department.
It is with a heavy heart I report that Mick Mulvaney is up to his old tricks again. You might remember how Mulvaney was a loud member of the Tea Party caucus, a key figure at the heart of the many government shutdown fights during the Obama era. Now he's doing the same, this time from the White House as Trump's Office of Management and Budget Director. According to a report published today by Politico, Mulvaney is encouraging congressional Republicans to attach anti-immigrant policy riders to must-pass legislation. The federal government is set to run out of money at the end of the month if Congress doesn't do anything. Democrats have already warned that Republicans are attempting to attach border wall money to government funding legislation, and they have vowed to push for, quote, a clean bill. The policy rider that Mulvaney is gunning for is a move to withhold federal grant money from so-called sanctuary cities, municipalities who don't fully cooperate with federal immigration enforcement because they're justifiably afraid it would wreak havoc on their communities. The filibuster does still exist for legislation, so any successful budget deal will need to get 8 Senate Democrats on board, which really shouldn't be too difficult. If there is an impasse, though, say if the White House holds firm on the sanctuary cities issue, then Republicans could always decide to go fully nuclear on the filibuster. They probably won't, but who knows, folks? Who knows? Trump could ask them to, and as we've said, we know how Republicans like falling in line. Speaking of immigration, Jeff Sessions announced yesterday that he's ordering federal prosecutors to take a harder line on undocumented immigrants. Addressing Border Patrol agents in Arizona, Sessions said that U.S. attorneys must now prosecute, quote, the transportation or harboring of aliens. He also wants to see more felony charges for unlawful entrance, including a directive to, quote, charge criminal aliens with document fraud and aggravated identity theft. While most of Washington was focused on Sean Spicer's latest Hitler gaffe, immigrants' rights advocates lashed out at Sessions' initiative. One said, quote, this is what happens when people who are too racist to be judges are appointed to lead entire departments of our government. Mi Gente field director Jacinta Gonzalez also said that Sessions' move aims to criminalize immigrant life and dissent, and that it opens the door to government intimidation and harassment of entire communities and the civil rights defenders within them. One winner, or two winners, of the Sessions announcement, the largest private prison corporations in the country. Geo Group and CoreCivic stock prices both rose yesterday at the opening bell. They were both up about a dollar per share in the first hour of trading.
CoreCivic, we see you. Yeah. Used to be Corrections Corporation of America. Changed their name. Still shitty. You don't need to look far for stories about how much Guantanamo Bay sucks. From the unlawful indefinite detention, to the torture, to its use as a recruitment tool for terrorists, Guantanamo has a lot of problems.
Wait. Do you remember that Business Insider article about how Guantanamo is actually good because they have PlayStation?
They've got soccer fields too, so it's okay that we're anally force-feeding people there.
And the orange jumpsuits are actually when the hot Cuban sun hits the orange. Okay, I'll stop.
It gets worse at Gitmo, though. A lawsuit was filed on Tuesday by a group of military attorneys who are alleging that the prison camp is literally killing them, that Gitmo is giving people cancer. 9 people who worked at Gitmo's Camp Justice, the main hub for military commissions activities, have been diagnosed with cancer, many in their 30s and 40s, and 3 have since died. The lawsuit alleges that the U.S. Navy is to blame and that it's known about the possible environmental contamination in the area, which used to be an airplane hangar and stored all sorts of toxic substances. The DOD Inspector General was notified in September 2015 about all this, but then the U.S. Navy conducted what the lawsuit described as a flawed review of the campsite that determined that living conditions were safe. Subsequent probes found that to be bullshit, though. Instead, inspectors found lead paint chips, mold, asbestos. In the air, they found carcinogens like mercury and formaldehyde. Despite that, the lawsuit states, quote, defendants took no step to protect military commissions personnel from the risks associated with the carcinogens found at Camp Justice. The lawsuit calls on the military to relocate the attorneys to new living quarters until a more thorough test can be conducted to determine just how severe the health hazards are. I have a better idea. Maybe we could just close the whole fucking thing down. Guantanamo, that is.
Yeah, and give it back to Cuba.
Next up, EPA Chief Scott Pruitt spent most of his career demonizing the Environmental Protection Agency, and now as the head of it, he's afraid for his personal safety. The New York Times reports that Pruitt is boosting his own security detail at the EPA, adding 10 new security guards to give himself around-the-clock 24/7 protection, a first for EPA chiefs. The boost in security spending comes as the agency prepares for major cuts to staff, offices, and environmental stewardship programs. Myron Ebel, who led Trump's environmental transition team, justified Pruitt's request for more security, telling E&E News, quote, "I think it's prudent, given the continuing activities by the left to foment hatred and the reported hostility within the agency from some unprofessional activists." So Pruitt is afraid of the left, and he's afraid of his own employees in this case. Get a new diaper, Scott. Get a new diaper.
He probably just wants a wall of meat between him and people who are criticizing him. Because I figure as Oklahoma Attorney General, he probably didn't deal with much criticism. Finally, don't call it a comeback. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said that he's once again seeking Iran's highest non-supreme leadership position. The hardliner registered to run in upcoming Iranian presidential elections today, and Ahmadinejad made the move despite warnings not to by Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei. The New York Times quoted Khamenei as saying in September that an Ahmadinejad candidacy would be, quote, harmful for the country. But can he win over the NASCAR dads and the fix the debt voters in the Tehran suburbs? Only time will tell. I don't know about you, but I look at the world with Donald Trump leading the biggest nuclear power and think maybe, just maybe, this situation could do without another administration with bad opinions on the Holocaust. I don't know. I'm a Rouhani man myself. I hope, Rouhani beats him.
You're Rouhani's base. Okay, as promised at the beginning of the show, we decided to figure out what the hell happened in Kansas.
What was the matter with Kansas, one might even say.
Yeah, sum this up, basically. What happened last night, Sam?
Oh, well, James Thompson, a Bernie-crat, had won the primary. This was for a special election for Mike Pompeo's seat. Pompeo, of course, vacated the seat when he became CIA director. And in the run-up to the election, it was looking very close. But despite this, national Democrats were not putting money behind the Thompson campaign. The DCCC only offered to help really on the last day.
And as a result, or, you know, one contributing factor, Thompson lost by not that much last night. He lost by about 7 or 8 points.
Right.
So we reached out to someone who advised the Thompson campaign, Ben Poteet, who he's a state party official, and he advised the Thompson campaign on veterans issues. So we brought him on the show and kind of talked about what happened.
So we've been hearing a lot about how the Thompson campaign didn't get help from the Democratic Party establishment. People who are close to where we are now in Washington. Do you agree with that narrative? What should our listeners know about the dynamic between the Thompson campaign and national Democrats from what you could tell?
Okay. Well, first of all, I don't know if you're aware, there was an issue with our state party as well with funding. I'm on the executive committee. I was on the call, and I voted, obviously, for our state party to invest in the race. And unfortunately, we didn't have enough votes to give the campaign at that time the $20,000 that they asked for.
That seems strange. What else would the state campaign and party do other than, you know, fight for candidates that are running in that state under that party?
Exactly. well, to be fair, there's a lot of great people at the Kansas Democratic Party. We just took back 13 seats in the legislature this year, which was big for our state. That has some issues to do with the governor, though. But, you know, we just had a big election here, so it's not as if they had a plethora of money left over, even though I felt like it was doable for them to contribute. They did help in other ways, and we appreciate that. But really, you know, I agree that anytime you have an opportunity like this, that everyone should kind of be all hands on deck, so to speak. And we didn't feel that they took the race as serious as they should have. And this is why the Democratic Party has lost races throughout the country the last, however long, decade or so.
Thompson identified as a Bernie-crat, and I'm wondering, you know, without getting too much into the counterfactual, do you think that had something to do with the state party's reluctance to get behind him?
No, I think that there's just a couple, older, more people that have been involved politically for years here that are, you know, they don't want a lot of change. They'd rather have some of the status quo. Not everybody, like I said, there's some great people. But a lot of the, you know, establishment Democrats, they didn't it's not as if they had anything against Thompson or anything. They just, we don't feel like, or at least the people on the Thompson campaign, I don't want to speak for them. I feel like they would agree with me that their voice was being heard. And I'll be honest with you, the people that ran his campaign in Thompson are much smarter in terms of their messaging and their ability to recruit good candidates that can be successful. So we just really want the people that have been around to start, you know, listening to the younger crowd, and not even younger, but the people that are motivated to change things. We have some work to do. I just think that it's a slower process than everybody wants it to happen overnight, you know, to change the leadership, but it's going to take years.
Estes described himself in the race as the underdog. Trump tweeted out today that Estes was the underdog and he was outspent by enormous amounts of money. what was the actual case on the ground when in this election?
So the FEC filing from before, it was like maybe two weeks before the election last night. Thompson had raised approximately 95% of his money was from small donations. The average donation, I think, was $25. And I do not remember the percentage of donations that Estes had from PACs and stuff, but it was his individual contributions were nowhere near 95%. It had to be about 50 or 60%.
Isn't the 4th district, don't the Kochs live in this district?
Yeah, the Kochs do live here. They live right here on the northeast side of town, and they are obviously very politically involved. I'd imagine they probably, if you look at the financial reports, I'm sure that I saw something about $70,000 they sent to the RNCC, I believe, who paid for advertising here the last couple days of the election. But what the news covered this story, though, and almost the entire process that the Thompson campaign ran was just by a really, really motivated, very, very smart staff and just lots of volunteers and small donations. That's literally it on their campaign. And I think we really did make him the underdog. I mean, I don't believe he was the underdog ever, Ron Estes. But here in the last week, I mean, they were, you know, it was not looking good for them, I guess you could say.
I want to ask, to what extent was the race about Trump? We hear stuff about how Kansas Republicans are uniquely horrible. So I'm wondering to what extent, you know, this was a referendum about Trump, or what was it much more about Brownback?
Yeah, I would say a few factors. Definitely a little more about Brownback because, you know, people here care about, you know, schools, most people, and the legislature and the governor have not done a very good job with handling the school funding issue, and people are obviously upset at that. So that's one factor. I think people are very motivated that tend to lean left or are registered Democrats, for the obvious reasons right now. So if the president, if he had anything to do with it, it was more of probably motivation of other people, like, you know, registered Democrats here. People were really motivated. And also, I don't want to undercut the fact that Jim Thompson was an amazing candidate, and it's really important to have candidates like him that can win or get close to winning here in states like Kansas. And his staff are brilliant. They're very, very smart. They're all about 30 or so. Most of them have law degrees or master's degrees, and, you know, they're just really, really a smart group of people.
closing this out here, did you learn anything from this whole process about Kansas? And should Republican lawmakers from Kansas be concerned after these results, maybe Congressman Yoder or whoever who might be facing re-election next year?
I definitely hope they're worried. They should start making some better decisions, or I hope that, you know, they need to take their job serious, though, and not, or I guess basically not just cater to registered Republicans. I don't think that's the job of lawmakers, shouldn't be to just register or care about some of their constituents. You should care about all of them. So I hope they're worried and they take their job serious. And I think there's some people that are really, really serious about changing Kansas, who I know and I'm friends with. And I think that people better watch out if they're going to continue dividing people. I think people are kind of over, not everybody, but over the divisiveness politically.
Ben Poteet, serving as our guy on the ground in Kansas, worked as an advisor to the Thompson campaign. Great work up there, despite all the circumstances. Thanks for coming on the show and giving us some insight on what exactly happened.
Thanks. Appreciate you guys having me. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
And that'll do it today. Before we end the show, let's check out the listener rant line.
Hey, this is Mike from Everett, a long-time listener. I guess a second-time caller. Just calling to get my 2 cents on the whole Sean Spicer situation. I don't know. I don't think he's up for the job. I really don't. I think he's too soft. I think Trump should pick Bill Belichick for his next press secretary. I don't know. You guys are the media types. You let me know what you think.
Well, thanks for the call, Mike. Mike, every time he calls, he talks about Boston sports teams.
Yeah. Surprise, no mention of the Bruins, who are probably not going to go far in the NHL playoffs. But I don't know.
Belichick is a man of few words, gets to the point real fast, doesn't seem like someone who'd get himself into trouble by just like talking about things he doesn't know about and spewing off dumb shit like Sean Spicer does. So I think he probably would be better at the role than Sean Spicer. Then again, why the hell would Bill Belichick want that?
I don't know. And I don't know if you're allowed to wear short sleeve sweatshirts from the White House podium.
Good point. I think we got one more message here.
Sam Knight. This is one of your demons calling. You've been making fun of a lot of liberals on Twitter.com. This pleases me, but you must feed me more owns. More owns, Samuel. More owns for your demon lord.
Sam, your Twitter behavior has literally conjured up the demons.
Man, I gotta go back to my shrink.
That's going to do it for the District Sentinel Radio newscast today, folks. Sponsors of the show include the Congressional Dish podcast, hosted by Jennifer Briney. Check it out at congressionaldish.com. Another sponsor, levelnews.org. Listen to this episode and all other episodes of the nightly newscast by going to districtsentinel.com. If you haven't yet, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Leave us a review. Give us a rating. Tell your friends to listen. We're back tomorrow. We're in D.C., so you don't have to be here.